Will you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Our speaker is being recorded tonight with her permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, Marcia, from here.
Well, hello. I'm Marcia, and I'm an alcoholic. And again, thank you for the privilege of being your secretary. It helped me a lot to get to this meeting and to stay involved. Anyway, let me get started. My sobriety date is December 8th, 1983, and my sponsor is Elena. And this has been my home group for a lot of years. The last couple of years, we bought a business a couple of years ago, and so I wasn't able to make it for a while. But I have been the last 6 months. Anyway, I want to tell you, when I got sober, it was totally by accident. And since I did get sober, I have never wanted to drink since I got sober. Just never wanted to. I remember what it was like. And when I say I never wanted to drink, I mean that. But I wanted to die many times from emotional pain. But I knew unequivocally that drinking wasn't going to do it. I just already know that. I'll give you a little bit about my background. I grew up in a large Navy family in the Southeast, and my dad died August 1st. You know, he died at 40 years old in 1960, and he had lung cancer. And my mother was 35 at the time. She had five kids, and she, before he died, we had a pretty normal household. She would sew and cook. You know, she always cooked, but she would sew for us, matching clothes, mother-daughter thing. And so she kept it between the ditches while my dad was alive. And then after he died, her alcoholism seemed to take hold, and she was pretty much absent from our lives. But we always had a great home, clean home, home cooked meals. I had, you know, beautiful clothes, because as I have been in this program and learned about everything, I guess to her that made her okay with herself, or that she was an okay, you know, good mom. And I have to tell you, my mom died about, she died about, 2 months ago at 87, and she would have been 88 next month. And I had the privilege of going down to Florida and walking her through the final days. And, you know, that's what the program has taught me, because the relationship I had with my mom growing up, you know, she was pretty brutal as her alcoholism progressed, and she didn't give me a lot of guidance. But you know, it's funny, as we get older and mature, I think we tend to look at what we did, you know, what we were taught and the gifts that were given to us. And I can see where she gave us many, many gifts in life. Whoops. And I was able to tell her those last few days, I was able to tell her, to thank her for taking us to church and teaching me about the God of my understanding, and for, she did a lot of really, and for teaching us to pray. Can you hear me, Darren?
Yeah.
Oh. And she, you know, cooked very good for us. I think she grew up kind of poor. She was Native American, and she always said she didn't have a lot growing up. But we always had, like, these vegetable gardens next to our house, and everything was home-cooked and homemade. And, boy, I don't know how to do any of that. I just, you know, depend on him. But anyway, we had all that neat stuff going for us. And I also forget to mention a lot of times in my story that my oldest brother and oldest sister have both died from this disease, and they died about 6 years ago or so. And I hadn't seen either of them in about 30 years, because they just didn't make it into mainstream society. And that's pretty sad. The rest of us have, and I think that all of us have a problem of some degree. I'm the only one that's gotten sober. But, you know, they all hear it, and they all know the language, and they all respect me. So that's pretty neat. Anyway, I'll tell you how I got sober. It was, first of all, when I grew up, I didn't really drink a lot. I was, you know, just did the high school stuff. And we had moved around, but my last time of moving, we'd moved my end of my junior year to Memphis, Tennessee. And I was, I was almost finishing high school, and it was just brutal, because I always lived near the ocean, in Florida and South Carolina, you know, always at the beaches. So this was like this inland place with only one high school in the whole town, and I was like, oh my God, that's why I'm an alcoholic, I know. But that's when I started smoking. This was in the 60s, and I was doing drugs then and all that. And that was part of the culture at the time. But it was also part of, I was really depressed living there. It was awful. And I graduated at 17. So the week I graduated, I left home. But part of the reason I left home was because of my mother's drinking, and she had remarried, and she and my stepfather had, he was a really good man. He was awesome. He golfed and hunted, and you know, that's what they do back in the South, and fished, and he was really good to us, but they were both alcoholics, and they used to have these huge fights. I mean, brutal, busting out, you know, kind of stuff. So I just, you know, didn't want to be around it anymore. And so I left, and I went back to Virginia Beach, where I had moved from. But during that time, I had applied for college because my dad died. It was all paid for by the military, and all I had to do that summer was get back on the plane, go back to Memphis. I was all registered, and I guess I was willing to do that. But the night before I was supposed to leave, it was the first of many times that I drank and used, and just said, I don't think I'll do that. And it changed the whole direction of my life. So I stayed in Virginia Beach, and you know, I was 17. I was out on my own, and it was, you know, I look at kids today and I go, God, they don't leave home until they're 40. So and that was pretty young to be out, I think. But a lot of us in that generation, I think we were. And anyway, I ended up going with this guy who had a great car, and he was about 12 years older than I. And I stayed with him for quite a few years. But guess what? I ended up having the same relationship with him that my mother had with her husband, man she married after my dad died. And, you know, it got to be, he was very violent. It didn't start out that way, of course. And this was back in the days where they didn't have shelters for women and they didn't have stalking laws, none of that stuff. So I was away from my family, and, you know, I just kept going back. That was the easiest thing to do. And I probably would have done it anyway because, you know, we just didn't have the education and those things at the time. But so we would get into these fights, and I never put the drinking and using together with the arguing. I never connected it. It was years later. It was years after I got sober that I connected that. But I, it would always start out, you know, a certain way, and you know, I think at some level I knew it was coming on, but I didn't know it up here yet. So we would separate, and I would date other people. We weren't married. We were just living together. That's back when they had cohabitation laws. Can you believe that? And then they undid that. So anyway, we were living together. And then when we would split up, for some reason I had this dichotomy going on. I would date, you know, I had judges and lawyers and bail bondsmen. Not at a conscious level did I do that, but I did that. And so when things got rough, you know, I've never gone to jail, and that's probably why. But things would get really rough with us. And we had split up one time and moved down to Savannah, Georgia. I met him down there. To get back with him, and this time the fighting had escalated, and he almost killed me. We were living in this historical house on East Gaston Street, down by one of the squares, and so the paramedics came, and they carried me in a stretcher down the stairs. I had to cut my jeans off. Oh my God, that was the worst part. The jeans, don't cut the jeans. Anyway, but they did, and anyway, I had to get sewn up, and you know, I still have scars from all that. But then the crazy insanity of it all is that I went back with him again. Now, this was all, you know, I don't know if it was the drugs or the alcohol. Because, you know, alcohol was just such a natural part of my life. Everybody around me drank and used like I did. My family did. My friends did. And this was also in the days of all those rock concerts, those outdoor rock concerts. And the ironic thing is my friends, even during that time when I was with this boyfriend, when I would get together with my girlfriends, they would always have me drive. Because what would happen is I looked like I was okay on the outside, but I wouldn't remember a thing. And, you know, that is part of my story. I was a huge blackout drinker. So to back, you know, just give you some other background, I've been married a couple more than once, and I always say that I don't have any children that I know of anyway. None have popped up yet. So now that remains a mystery. Anyway, so my girlfriends would always say, you know, let Marcia drive. And you know, when I think back on that, nobody ever got hurt. Nobody, I mean, that I know of. It was never reported if that happened. None of my friends. It could have been ugly, really bad. Today, looking at that, I just go, oh, my God. I would not have any idea. So anyway, and then I was the one that had this little apartment thing down at the beach, and everybody else was with their parents, so they would all come stay with me. And then if I needed a respite from our drinking and using, I would go stay with a girlfriend's family for a couple weeks and just kind of get, you know, grounded a little bit, and then back to it again. And at the time, I had started college at this little community college, And I went for a while, but then I got bored with it because all my friends were older and they were all having jobs and making money, and that's what I wanted to do. So I stopped doing that. Well, anyways, I was saying I had gone back and forth with this boyfriend, and we were in Savannah, and then that happened where he almost killed me. And so there was a warrant out for his arrest. So he came back to Virginia Beach, and I moved back because my family was up there. And I went back with him eventually. It was just so insane, and everybody was devastated that I did that. And I used to hear things like, God, Marcia, you've got so much going for you. Why don't you get away from him? And, you know, the surprise was it was really me I needed to get away from, but because I was just as much a part of it as I learned to work my steps and find out about that. I was just as much a part of it. But anyway, so we went back together, and at that time I had gone to cosmetology school, and I was starting that career. And while we were back together, at this time I got just a little more clarity of what was going on. And when we were drinking and doing whatever drugs we were doing, I knew that the argument, that the fight was getting ready to start. He was really very jealous. And so ultimately what happened, I'll keep it general, is that I almost killed him this time. And so I was bound over. I wasn't even 24 yet. When I was 23, I had already been, at that point, bound over to 2 grand juries. And the charges were ultimately dropped. And because I had a lot of friends downtown, and it was before computers and all that, I don't have any police record, never have. And, you know, it's just my journey. It's just the way it was. But the hell and the jail was right here. It was right here that I couldn't get away from. I mean, at least when you're in jail, they unlock it and you can leave. But I couldn't get away from it. And I didn't know that. I didn't know where, you know, I was trapped. I didn't know what the solution was. So what I did was I had friends from high school who had moved to Palm Springs. And every summer they came home and they said, you should move to California. You know, get away from here. So eventually I did that. But I moved to the desert first. And, you know, I like being by the ocean, so I didn't stay there long. But I hopped on the Beach Cities exit, and I was, you know, smoking pot and taking drugs to help me drink longer. That was really why I took them, so I could drink longer. And I never cared what it tastes like, but I just liked the feeling for sure. So I was driving on the freeway, and I got stopped for speeding. And this was in March of 1980. And this highway patrolman, he wrote me a speeding ticket, and as he was walking away, he said, keep your beer down. So I had a six-pack of beer in the car. So, you know, I know they don't do that today, and that was just my journey. You know, I just wasn't meant to go behind bars, I guess. So, and I certainly wouldn't like that, man. If I ever had thought about drinking, I would, you know, that's not something I would enjoy, I'm sure. So anyway, I end up in Newport Beach, and I thought the whole world lived like they did in Palm Springs and Newport Beach by then, and I was working on this yacht, and, you know, I just had no clue. I was so out of it. I always said I was not a morning drinker, and I wasn't, but what I would do, first thing when I opened my eyes in the morning, I'd light up a joint. I didn't know to drink in the morning. I would have done that. Nobody ever told me it would get rid of that awful feeling, and I don't know why I didn't know that, but, you know, so I would smoke pot. But I would always, when I woke up in the morning, I'd feel so depressed and shaky, you know, and we quit drinking to partying, but I would always get depressed after I drank. You know, during the time, I guess I had fun, what I remember of it was fun, but then the next day, I would be so depressed that I would, you know, I just really felt like, I would crash hard, and I'd call people and try to find out what we did, you know, what'd we do, and, you know, every summer I had a great time, so I kept doing it. And anyway, so I moved out here and still went through all that. I knew at some level that something was wrong with me, but I didn't know what, and I didn't know what to do about it. I thought I didn't want to drink or use anymore, but I didn't know how not to do that. You know, it's kind of funny when we first come here, people say, oh, just keep coming to meetings and don't drink in between meetings. And you know, what that sounds like to a newcomer is probably, you know, jump in the air and stay there. You know, how do you do that? How do you do that? And I don't know how you do that, and I don't know how this program works, but I guarantee you I know it works. This is living proof, you know, almost, what, 29 years? Yeah, I got sober at 30, if that tells you anything that I don't want you to know. But anyway, so every big birthday is big on both sides. Anyway, so I was in Newport Beach, and I went down to drink at the White House one afternoon, and I was taking speed to drink longer. And I drank all day, and I was drinking these Mai Tais, and that, even if I could drink, I would never drink those again. But it was getting near the end of the day, and I know it gets like a lot of traffic even back then, so I wanted to go back to my car and drive home. And I couldn't see. I walked outside, you know how when you've been in a bar all day long, you walk out. And so I saw this guy walking down the sidewalk, and he had a nice tan, he had blue eyes, and blonde hair, and I went, oh, excuse me, would you mind walking to my car? And he was like, oh, no, I'll walk you to your car. And anyway, I ended up marrying him a little bit later, but he was like, he and I had a crazy relationship because we did a lot of drinking, but the thing was, that's how I got sober because of him. I'm so grateful to him. He would get in trouble with his drinking. He would get in, you know, DUIs and car wrecks. And I'd be going, what is wrong with him? You know, I never got that. I never got in a wreck. I never got a DUI. And I just couldn't figure out what was wrong with this guy. So what would happen was he would be out after work and he'd be drinking and missing in action. I'd be so worried. I would just be pacing the floors, worried, worried, worried. And then the minute he came home, I would be in a rage and I would be trying to run over him with a car. You know, if you're ever one of my neighbors, I apologize right now, but I would try to, you know, go in front of the car and I'd go, and he'd jump on the hood of the car. And, you know, it was just nuts. And do you know, telling you this, I didn't even realize this until years after I got sober. I had no idea because it was just part of who I was. And I'd chase him around the house with a knife. I'm gonna kill you. And so, I mean, he was generally really afraid of me. So I had a little business in San Juan, and my husband at the time had a business. And I would go outside, and I'd eat my lunch with this lady who worked next door. She was a seamstress. And I would tell her the stuff I'm telling you guys. Like, you know, just this normal person. I'd be chatting with her about trying to run over my husband with a car or trying to kill him with a butcher knife that he came home drunk. Excuse me. And she said, oh, honey, she said, you need to go to Al-Anon. And I went, what's that? And she said, well, it's for families and friends of alcoholics. And I was really alcoholics. She was calling my husband an alcoholic. And so anyway, but the thing was, is I was so miserable and desperate that I thought, man, I'll do anything. So I went. And at the time I lived in Mission Viejo, and there weren't all the meetings around that there are now. I think Rocky mentioned that when he spoke. There just weren't all the meetings we have. We are so lucky. But I remember going up to Costa Mesa for my first meeting. And when I came back, I knew something was different. I knew I heard something, but I didn't know what it was. What happened is I kept going. Is I started learning the facts about alcoholism. You know, I remember when I first started going there, and when I'm in AA, I identify as an alcoholic, but this is how I got sober, so that's why I'm telling you this. When I first started going, I mean, it was AA and it was Al-Anon, and you don't mix it. You don't tell, you don't, it's a, you know, it's not discussed, because you're there for this reason, you're there for this reason. And so now they have all the double winner meetings and all that, and that's fine, but I had the black belt Al-Anon stuff, and Elsa Chamberlain was in the meetings that I went to, Chuck C's wife, and Dr. Paul's wife, and eventually Dr. Paul started coming, and some friends in here were there, and, you know, it's just, to me, it was a total blessing. But what I started hearing in that program was I was hearing the facts about alcoholism. I heard about periodic drinking. I didn't know what that was. I heard about blackouts, and I heard about, periodic drinking and blackouts. And then, oh yeah, then they started talking about feelings, like fear. And I never knew, I didn't know I had any fear. I didn't know I had anger. Can you even believe that after what I'm telling you? And so I swear to you, I did not know I was angry. And so I called this lady then who I had lived with, and her name was Shirley, and she had been, I'd rented a room from her before I married my first husband, and she used to always put this book by my door, and it was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd be going, what is a book going to do to change my life? I mean, really, a book? And so I'd just look at it and kind of flip through it and put it back by her door. And so so as I kept going to the Al-Anon meetings, and we know that when the light went on, what it was when I heard about blackouts. I went, that's what that's called? You know, there's a name for what I would do, not remember anything. And it was just stunning to me, absolutely stunning. So I called her up and I said, Shirley, I said, you know, do you think I could be an alcoholic? And she said, well, Marcia, if you have to wonder whether you are or aren't, you probably are. And, you know, the truth is, I don't care what you call it. You know, the big thing when I got sober was, is it a disease or not? Is it, you know, it's all that. I don't care what it is. I don't care what you call it. Call me anything. But let me work these 12 steps, because that's where my life began. And as a matter of fact, it was really funny. I think I was quite a few years into my program before I really, really learned to work the steps ongoing. But anyway, so Shirley became my first sponsor. And Shirley, that little lady, is down in Florida, down by where my mom is. And I just saw her daughter the other day, her daughter-in-law. And she's her days are numbered right now. And, you know, I would have gone to see her when I went down to see my mother, but, of course, my mom was dying, so I didn't. But she was such a gift in my life, as is Elena. I mean, just the time people put in when they're your sponsor and the things they walk you through and the guidance that we get. I mean, somebody talked about Greg, about we don't shoot our wounded. And so what it becomes eventually after we take away the drugs and the alcohol is about behavior. And, you know, it's just the crazy things I used to do, and they would just love me right through it. And, you know, just, it's hard for me to be around newcomers now. God, it spins my head, you know, if they're really brand new sober. But we do that, and we're the ones that stay the course. And, you know, they bounce up and down and all around, but we're the ones that stay the course for them. And it's kind of like the business I'm in now. I deal with a lot of people who are ill, and I have to, like, be the kind of the rock or the cheerleader or the whatever, and they go up and down. But, you know, that's what this program teaches us. And so this sponsor, you know, she walked me through that really crazy stuff in the beginning, along with an Al-Anon sponsor, because I worked both programs simultaneously for years, and a lot of people never knew I was in both of them. So, anyway, the real trauma of my early sobriety is that first husband decided to leave me, and I was really, I couldn't even believe it. He was leaving me, and he was not sober, and I was sober 5 years. It was such an insult. But I can see why, because he was scared to death of me, and I was just getting crazier and crazier. But that's when I really started to grow, when I was not able to focus on anybody else but me. Because as long as I was still with him and he was still drinking and using, it was easy. You know, I was fine, and he was not. So 5 years sober, we got divorced, and I changed everything about my life, like this gentleman was saying, that we don't do in early sobriety. Well, I think in early divorce, it's not a great idea either. Because I really had the hardest time in my sobriety that I've ever had. I changed everything. I moved from our home. And, you know, I had a stepson at the time. I was just, like, totally with me, and that was really bad. But Dr. Paul helped me through a lot of that at the time, because I didn't tell him, but I'm sure I was suicidal at the time. But, you know, I had to lose 5 pounds first before I did anything, and so I'm still here. Anyway, he helped me through all that, and I went away in sobriety to a place in Arizona for about a week that I paid for myself just to kind of regroup and feel safe. And also, Dr. Paul encouraged me to go to an assertiveness training class, and, you know, that really worked well, if you guys know me. So, no problem with that at all anymore. As a matter of fact, you know, that we say in the program that the pendulum swings with our character defects and things that we're going through, the pendulum swings. So, you know, first I was way over where I didn't know how to say what was on my mind, ask you what you meant by that. Then it swung way over here till, you know, I didn't give a crap what you meant by that, and I didn't, you know, all that. So then, you know, finally it gets somewhere in the middle, right, honey? With the help of my diplomatic sweet husband, it has gotten somewhere in the middle most of the time. Or some of the time or something. But anyway, so got through that difficult part of my life, and I was already in my late 30s and I wanted children, and so I was like at some level of consciousness wanting to marry someone who wanted kids, so I got married again, and it was not the best choice I've ever made, but he'd never been married before, and he was like in his late 40s, and I was like, oh, you want to marry me? And so, but the best thing I learned about that and that marriage was about myself again. It seems like every relationship I learn about me, whether it's friendships, whether it's work relationships, no matter what it is, it's always what I learn about me. And this man didn't know how to share his life, and, you know, he wasn't right or wrong for that. It's just what it was. And eventually, you know, I was really lonely. I had gone back to school to finish that degree I started 20 years earlier, and I started learning things that people respected what I had to say, like professors and my peers, my student peers, and so I started feeling pretty good about myself. And whereas I felt real invisible in that marriage, I felt really invisible and lonely. And so the week I graduated, I actually got published, and I hadn't even meant to become a writer. That was just God's work. And so I'd become a writer, and I gave my ex-husband about a year to see if things would improve, and things improved a bit, but, you know, it was just really a lonely time. So we ended up getting divorced, but while we were getting divorced, as we were doing that, we found out he had a terminal illness, And he, so I was willing to help him out a little bit to take his medication off. But he actually got killed in a car accident, in a single car accident. And I had met my wonderful husband by then, Johnny, Jack. And but Joe had been calling me, and he had been he had been clean and sober when we got divorced for about 15 years. And when he got on this medication, he was like insane. He was so insane. And so I'm sure that's what happened when he got killed. It was part of that addiction. But he didn't ever drink again. You know, you got to hand him that. So his son had called me up, and the son was about 14 when we got divorced. And he, I hadn't seen him in all these years. He was about 18 then. And he told me his dad had died. And it was, you know, just really a sad time. Then I get a call about a year later, I think it was, and that son had committed suicide. He was almost 19. So, you know, I've seen a lot of family members, and I've seen a lot of people in this particular room who are not here anymore because of that. And it's a serious thing. You know, we make a lot of jokes and we have a lot of fun here, but there are a lot of people who don't make it. And that's the deal. You know, I've never gone out, thank God, by God's grace, really, I know that. But I know a lot of people don't make it back. And there's nothing we can do for them. You know, it's like I heard somebody say, and people ask me sometimes, what can I say? What can I do about their loved one who's drinking or using? And, you know, they say even if God himself or Bill W. came and sat down beside that person, if they're not ready to hear it, they're not going to hear it. You know, all we can do is be an example and be there when they're ready and love them and that kind of thing. So anyway, Anthony ended up, he and another young man killed themselves together. And that was kind of shocking. But the thing is, no matter what we experience in life or who we're close to that passes, we don't have to kill our pain. We walk through that. And things do get a little bit better a little bit at a time. But on to sobriety here, you know, what helps me get through those kind of things when I'm feeling vulnerable and I'm feeling, you know, like, where is God and what's going on, is I just come to these rooms. I buckle up on my meetings, I bump it up, and I stay close, and God always speaks through you guys. And I'll tell you really quickly what happened the day before I flew down to see my mom. I was really spinning about going because it's a long trip, and I'm really busy with my business. I knew she would know who I was, or I thought she wouldn't. And so I was telling my husband, he knew it was coming up, and I said to him, I went home and he was lying on the bed reading or something, and I had my computer in that room at the time, and I said, you know, honey, I think it's time that I go, because my sister was dealing with this by herself. And he said, yeah, whatever you want to do, blah, blah, blah. So I'm looking at the computer, and, you know, flights were enormous for the next day. And then I was going, God, it's a long flight, blah, blah, blah. And then I stood up and I said, nah, I don't think I'm going to go. And again, he's like, well, whatever you want to do. But it was like this audible voice went through my head. It was like AA or the God of my understanding that said, you don't go because you feel like it, and you don't go because it's convenient, and you don't go because the price is right. You go because this is what we do in this this is what we're taught to do. And I went, wow. And so I just told Johnny and Jack that I'm going, and sat down back at my computer, and my cell phone rang. And I don't have my cell phone number. Not many of my clients have my cell phone number. But this one client, whose wife was going through chemo, she'd finished her chemo, but she needed another product of what I have. And so he called me. I thought of the number, and I went, man, I feel like talking. They're really nice people. That's why they have my number, but I didn't know if I felt like talking. I thought, okay, I'm looking at the computer. I may as well. So we're chatting, and they were telling me, we're discussing the price of this product. And then I said, well, so-and-so, I said, do you have any air miles you want to swap? So lo and behold, he made my reservation. Everything was taken care of, and she got the best there was of what she wanted. So it's just amazing to me when we do the right thing. It's just, I mean, I couldn't have planned that phone call, or I didn't even think of him having air miles or anything. Or was he willing? It just all unfolded that way. So anyway, I've only got about 10 minutes left, but I want to tell you, sorry, I had an allergy pill, that the way I work this program ongoing is I do those four columns all the time. And the most important thing about those four columns is the last one, is what is my part in it? And that's something I teach to the people I sponsor right off the bat. Because, you know, you can work the steps. You can do the step one, the powerlessness, and figuring out our insanity thing and knowing God's going to restore us. But when you get down to really daily living and what's going on here, the way I decipher it is with those columns. And when I can see what my part in it is, that's when the God in my life can work. And by the way, the God in my life is really responsible for who I am today. I mean, I always say that I would not be the woman I am today without alcohol, you know, God, Alcoholics Anonymous, and my fabulous team of surgeons, of course. But anyway, rigorous honesty. So when I am working on a character defect, you know, I can only do my part, and then I turn it over to the God of my understanding. And it's in God's time. I mean, you know, sometimes I would just like the freedom to have something removed from me. But if it's of useful purpose to God, then it sticks around or until I'm really willing and desperate. And but eventually, you know, I've seen things change in my life that I never thought would change. My reactions to things. I mean, it's amazing. And the people I sponsor, you know, invariably I'll sponsor women that have the same conditions that I've had. And it usually has to do with money, guys, sex, you know. Oh, by the way, Jack and I were down. I was asked to speak in Key West a few years ago. And so we flew down there. And these guys that were speaking before they were from, like, heavy hitters from Canada and Atlanta and all this, these great radio voices. And so I told my husband, I was the Sunday closing speaker. And I said, you know, honey, I'm going to have to kick it up a notch. You know, you might not be really comfortable with what I have to say. So anyway, so I told them at that group, I said, you know, men always talk about how many cars they wrecked and how many DUIs they had. And I said, but at my women's meeting, we had a contest one time to see who slept with the most famous person. And, you know, I came this close to winning, but it was the night I said no to Elvis. And the girl that won had slept with an astronaut. So that was my claim to fame. You know, when I live in Memphis, got to take advantage of it all. Anyway, so about working the steps. back work of this stuff. Yeah. Anyway, that's where I find my peace. It's when I find my part, because then, you know, people are it's okay for people to be who they are, and I can't do anything about that. But what I can do, the only place I have any power, is in my own life. And so that's my responsibility to work on. And the way I do that is to report in when I'm baffled by something. And, you know, as time has gone on, I intuitively know how to handle those things that used to baffle me. And what used to baffle me was life in general. But now it's maybe specific situations. You know, and I'll talk it over with people I trust. And my early sponsor taught me how to make decisions. She didn't ever make decisions for me. And maybe I didn't need that, or maybe she thought I was just way too far gone to try. But she would tell me, you know, you can do anything you want if you're willing to pay the price. Go ahead, do what you want. Sleep with him, or, you know, spend that, or go here, go there. You can do anything, but who's going to pay the price? Me. And that's what I try to teach the ladies I sponsor. You know, everybody makes their own decision, no matter what we tell them, no matter, you know, it's like having kids. You tell them something's going to hurt them, you know, everybody's got to do their deal. And anyway, so that's been a great lesson for me, because just like alcoholism, I learned to think through situations, and it's been a real gift in my life. Working with newcomers, I think, has been huge too, because people, they don't have to be brand new, don't get me wrong, but working with new people and working the steps, because I didn't realize in the beginning what that could do for us until I read this quote one time that said it all. It's like, it said, helping somebody else up the mountain brings us closer to the top ourselves. And that's what it is. You can't work with somebody and get them there without being there too. And I just, you know, I was baffled for the longest time. What is working with a newcomer going to do to make me forget this horrible mess over here? But that's what it is. It just gives me a spiritual high. And then to see someone actually start changing and growing, it's just awesome. So I'm going to wrap this up, but I want to say that, you know, quitting drinking, and Dr. Paul wrote a book about that, is but the beginning. It's like we have second stage recovery after that. After we all quit drinking or doing whatever we're doing, then we're all left with a piece of people, places, and things. And it's called life. And that's what the program also teaches us, is how to deal with those situations. And we're not going to do it perfectly. I know that. I see it. I see myself. I see you guys. But what we have is a way to correct ourselves when we don't. We can go back and say, you know, I could have handled that better. I'm really sorry. And, you know, I used to be so stubborn about that. No, I'm not going to apologize to them. You know, I'm not going to apologize. And, you know, what does that do? As we get more mature and become adults, you know, it's just really, it's called being gracious when we can look at ourselves and go, God, I screwed up. And, you know, it's not anything that I made up or created. It's what the program teaches us. So when we mess up, we have a way. And the regular person out there doesn't have this. They don't have these skills. You know, sometimes I talk to my clients and they go, they think, oh, my God, she's so brilliant. She's so wise. You know, that's a big book. But or I have a client going through something. I go, oh, okay, write down these columns. And they go, okay. And they'll do the columns. Can I take this with me? I go, yeah, take it with you. And so they use it as a resource. But it's really funny how we can help other people generate growth in their lives without even, they don't even know they're working the 12 steps. But anyway, I hope to keep growing and changing and, you know, just helping other people as life goes on. And being sober, I wouldn't have it any other way. Wouldn't have it any other way. And I go to functions where there's alcohol and I'm not even tempted. Now, the cake's another story, but anyway, that's another thing. So I encourage you, if you're new, please get a big book and please read it and please work the steps, because you will, as we say here, have a life beyond your wildest dreams. I never had any idea. I met my husband in this room, my third husband, but my last husband, and we got married in this church over here. And you know, we really have a really great relationship. There's a mutual respect for each other that I never had with a partner before, and we're a team. And you know, I just never knew my life could be this way. And anyway, I don't know how God brought such a man into my life, but I'm sure glad he did. And I'm really grateful for all you guys and for my sobriety. And thank you for letting me be secretary.